Okay, my name is Molly Marin. I'm the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. Just a few reminders before we get started today. A copy of today's PowerPoint is available on our webpage if you want to go out and grab that to follow along. There's both a full copy as well as a handout copy. I know some folks asked for the handout copy last week, so we put both of those out there for you. At the end of today's presentation, I will post a link to an evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we very much appreciate the feedback. It's a very short evaluation, and we do look at those every week. Also, during today's presentation, if you can use the chat box for any questions or comments you may have, Dr. Gersten will be looking at that probably break halfway, and then, of course, at the end, there'll be time for questions, so please use that chat box. Today is the second webinar in our Understanding RTI in Mathematics series. We hope you can join us for the other webinars in this series, as well as our Strand 7 series, Database Decision-Making in an RTI Process, which starts next Monday. More information on all upcoming webinars, as well as registration information, can be found on our webpage. Today, we're very pleased to have back with us Dr. Russell Gersten. Dr. Gersten is a professor with the College of Education at the University of Oregon and director of Instructional Research Group in Southern California. He served on the National Math Panel, co-chairing the Committee on Instructional Practice. He also chaired the panel that created a practice guide for RTI mathematics for the U.S. Department of Education. In his 20s, he reviewed R&B for Rolling Stone and the Boston Phoenix and interviewed many of the stars of that era, such as Al Green and Gladys Knight. Welcome, Dr. Gersten.
Thank you, Molly. This is the second session, and the focus is going to be on screening as well as a framework for RTI, because one thing I'm going to stress, especially in the latter half of this talk, is that having a plan and thinking about reasons for things, as RTI in general gets into a second decade, becomes very important. Resources, as we all know, are limited. And really thinking about what screening measure to use, what kind of intervention to use, where, which grade levels to start, should be more than let's do it the way this county does it or let's do it the way this person does. And the name of the series by intention is Understanding RTI in Math. So I'm less going to talk about particular things to do, but the concepts that underlie them. Today, the focus is going to be on screening, but we're going to start with two things. One is something left over from last week. It's very brief, but it's some contemporary, very, very recent research on Tier 1 math instruction in the lower grades and what seems to work. And the second is I want to share some of the work on preventative interventions in math and basically the factors that lead to what seem to lead to math difficulties up the road, because reading, we had the benefit of almost a century of research, and we don't have such a body of research now in math, and this should really help guide what we do in screening. Next week after the Thanksgiving holiday, we'll be talking a lot about what to teach in interventions and how to teach it. And that is kind of, to me, the heart of the series. The last session, I'll be co-presenting with Sarah Powell from University of Texas on December 9th, and we'll be talking about progress monitoring and also especially its use in Tier 3 or intensive intervention, which has become a topic of pretty broad interest. Now it's time for the first two poll items, which Molly will put up, and they're both pretty straightforward. Just gives us a sense of who the audience is. like we have about everybody, so just to recap what folks can see too, about a third of you are interventionists. We have about 11% special ed teachers, 11% school psychologists, some math specialists, some RTI coordinators, and some math teachers, and some teachers of cross-subject. So we have pretty much the wide array of the personnel involved with cut across the whole body. And folks are feeling they have some knowledge of RTI and math, which is good. And reading is variable for the group in terms of knowledge. But between some and high, it's definitely on the high end, which is good, something I'll keep in mind in my comments, and really will appreciate questions from folks. So I think we can take down the poll and start getting into this. So so basically, there are two recent studies. They have not gotten tons of attention. One of them has gotten some Twitter feeds and other things, but this study here is not well known, and it basically was a huge study involving hundreds of classrooms, approximately 250 classrooms in a nationally representative sample, and it was done relatively recently, at 2006-07. And it talks about some of the things that are correlated with, that seemed linked to higher student achievement. One thing about the study is the range of curricula looked at was wide, which is good for a study that's looking for associations. It ranged from investigations, which is a very guided discovery-oriented approach to teaching math, to Saxon, which is quite directive, to Karen Fuson's program Math Expressions, which is based on Korean math and uses a lot of Asian techniques, and the more eclectic Scott Forsman math, which is just a typical core basal that probably cuts across traditions and is intentionally eclectic. So you got to see quite a bit of teaching styles. And for first grade, the only thing that seemed to link with higher proficiency is teachers telling kids what strategy to use. Okay, now again, these are very young guys. It doesn't mean everything was dictated to them, but this is the one finding. Second grade, it seemed that when teachers asked the class if they agreed with the student's answer and maybe at least did something to increase engagement in Tier 1 instruction that was linked to higher achievement, the number of representations teachers demonstrated, which is something heavily stressed in Common Core, seems an important linkage. And I know some of you were probably cutting across Tier 1 and Tier 2. And possibly Tier 3. And so the use of visual representations seems to be something that will contribute. And the other thing is, in my mind, peer-assisted learning, that structured peer-assisted learning activities where kids have opportunities to explain things to each other in math seems to work. The two things that lowered math proficiency, one is a surprise. That asking kids to solve problems multiple ways was not associated with lower achievement. Now, we don't know exactly the answer. This could well have been done in a confused way, not the most capable way. We don't know that, but this is a finding. And the other thing was having a lot, at least in second grade, a lot of teacher-led discussions. All student-led math discussions was linked to lower achievement. And having watched some of this, I could see, especially with kids this young, where a lot of time going to that could decrease from achievement because it can go off in a lot of different directions, and in student engagement can meander quite a bit. Another important study was done. Now, this used earlier data, way back from 98, and the findings here have gotten some attention. And there, Paul Morgan and George Farkas were the lead authors here. And basically, this again just came out this year. When researchers adjusted for everything, at-risk students did better with teacher-directed practice, and they did better with what the survey, because these were self-reports, called drill and practice, which to me meant they were practicing math a lot. So there was a mix of work on procedures, including small group and everything from flashcards to partner kind of work on problems. And for the not at-risk students, the students above the 25th percentile, both teacher-directed and student-centered practices raised achievement. So in that case, the combination seems the best. What this is telling me in terms of tier two interventions is the at-risk students need a greater ratio of teacher-directed practices. So to change the ratio, the intervention time is a perfect time to do it. I'm now going to talk quickly about framework for RTI. This was a project we did approximately 5 years ago. I chaired this group. It was done for Institute for Ed Sciences, or IES, for the U.S. Department of Ed. And this is the group of folks there. Some may be familiar names to you. Sybilla Beckman is a research mathematician who's gotten very interested in math ed, and she has authored a book that's used in math content classes around the country. Ben Clark has done a lot of work in progress monitoring screening. Ann Fagan has also done work in progress monitoring screening, and both have more of a school psych special ed background. Laurel Marsh was a practitioner on the panel and was a math specialist at the time. John Starr is more of a cognitive researcher, and Brad Witzel, more kind of middle school pre-algebra special ed math researcher. This is a framework which I'd like you to look at, and then there's going to be a poll. I used to read, these are what we as a panel deliberated for about 9 months, had a lot of research reviewed, and then we developed these eight, and this is truncated here, but these were the eight pillars, we thought, of RTI, and the level of scientific evidence is next to it. I'm going to talk more about many of these next week, but what I'd like you to do now is poll three, which is Molly will put on in a second, which is to read it and think about which is the biggest surprise to you in terms of evidence. So there is your poll. And the key is to make sure you see which is the biggest surprise. And give it a couple of minutes. Okay, I think we have most folks responding, and I'm just going to address this framework very briefly. It's really something more to think about, and we'll go into it in more detail, except for the screening today. But the biggest surprise, I assume, was the lack of evidence of progress monitoring for children receiving interventions or in the at-risk category. And this is invariably the winner of these polls when I've done them around the country, different presentations. I know it goes against the RTI dogma. This is the reason the evidence was low. All the research that we found, and there were quite a few showing effective interventions for kids, be they below the 15th percentile, kids whose scores were very low on something analogous to AIMS-Web or whatever. Basically, the issue was that the progress monitoring done was daily, or in one case, weekly quizzes or daily mastery tests. In one or two studies, they did give a measure like an AIMS-Web or a CBM measure, but that data the teacher never saw, the interventionist never saw. So there was no evidence that progress monitoring caused anything to change, to improve for kids. And so we still wanted to put it in. We think it's a good way, in particular, a good way to get a sense of how the whole instructional program is going for a Tier 2 child. Because remember, they spend a lot of time in your classroom in your classroom or the elementary math classroom or the middle school math classroom, as well as in Tier 2. So it's a good way to gauge it. But we don't have compelling evidence that it's an essential part of an intervention. So it doesn't mean it isn't or it's a bad procedure, but that's the way it is. Before we move on to screening, so we're going to talk about these others over the next 2 weeks, except for screening. But I wanted to give you this framework because part of the work in screening is figuring out what your RTI system is. And that can include, by the way, not doing tons of progress monitoring unless you have a clear purpose for doing it. There's just one question that came up, and since it's pretty straightforward, there's Tricia Albrecht asked if there was that the research citation was missing on slide 5, and we will. What we'll do is email that to Molly right afterward, and she can post this on the website. It's a study by Doug Clements, who some of you know, especially for his early math research, and Roberto Agadini, that large study. And we'll give you the web address for that. And maybe John, my coordinator, will help mention that to Christopher. Okay. And let us go forward into screening. We now have a poll item. Poll item 3 we did. No, I didn't think so. Screening. One of the key things is what happening in schools, and it started in the 80s, but it's gotten more and more intense, is there's a lot of decisions to be made as people move into RTI math. And a lot of things are just done by tradition. People, what I've seen, is often set it up the same way reading was set up. Another decision that comes up, and there's an advisory group for the Michigan RTI implementation, and they were wondering, what grade do we start? If we want to start small and do it well, do we follow the guidance from reading and start in kindergarten and first grade? What about algebra readiness, though? It'll take 9 years till we maybe have dividends there, and so many kids fail algebra. And other things are, how do we fit this into the middle school or the high school, where sometimes there's double dose algebra? Sometimes kids who are behind in math, well behind, do poorly on the state test, take an extra period of math. How does that fit RTI? So those are all decisions that need to be made. I don't have exact answers, but what I'm going to try to do is share relevant evidence on those and a little bit of my thinking. And the second is, should the system be exactly the same as reading, especially given the large advances in technology since RTI and reading began wide use approximately 10 years ago, especially actually one of the first implementations was Frank Vellutino in the SUNY system. I'm forgetting the exact school right now. And then the third one is what to look at and what to look for in terms of screeners, predictive validity, concurrent validity, sensitivity, what else? So I'm going to at least open these issues up and try to do a few and some depth. There's a couple of quick surveys about your current RTI screening items that Molly will put up in a second. Okay. So what it's seeming like is about two-thirds of you have universal screening in math, and then quite a few others have it in some schools, but satisfaction is either okay or low, and it's just about an even split, give or take a couple of percentage points between the two, which is not atypical. A lot of the screening systems available were quick updates of things from the 90s or even the 1980s, and there hasn't been as much of a theoretical base or necessarily that much practical work in that area. So that gives us some sense that this is an area of need for us. And now we can move on, Molly, to the next slide. Okay. So one thing about the importance of early intervention, meaning kindergarten, first grade, early second grade, is it's very recent, last 5 years or so, that we have strong evidence. The other thing, which is becoming clear as it's become confirmed, because as sometimes two or three independent researchers find the same thing, especially if it's using large databases, then it's assigned something really solid is there, and it's becoming every bit as strong as the base for early intervention in reading. So I want to give you a little of that evidence because that seems critical for decisions folks make. Here, the reference has not disappeared, unlike slide five. Again, another recent article that just came out with my close colleague Bob Siegler and Greg Duncan and others is looking back all the way from from high school to first grade. This is what they found using a large nationally representative database from the National Institutes of Health, where they collected data on zillions of things about kids, a lot related to health, but included cognitive and academic, is that the very best predictor of how kids will do at age 15 in high school math is the growth they made between entering kindergarten and the end of first grade. So that seems kind of a strong finding. It's clear that kids enter kindergarten with different levels of math knowledge. It's totally obvious to any kindergarten teacher, and the playing field is not leveled. And in fact, the knowledge they bring with them is also a reasonable predictor. But that growth over those critical 2 years, where kids are really beginning to grapple with math being an abstraction out from reality, that is the strongest predictor. It's statistically significant. For those of you, and I'm sure the school psych folks and some others who know correlations, it's 0.4, which it doesn't mean it's hopeless, but it's certainly, for a period of 10 years, that's an incredibly strong predictive relationship. We're usually happy with 0.6, 0.7 over 1 year. What it also means, though, is it's not hopeless after the end of first grade that there are kids who didn't grow much, entered with low skills, who still do just fine. So, but the importance of doing more when kids are in that early, very, very receptive age is critical. This study involved 1,364 kids. It was nationally representative. It wasn't perfectly done, not that they're perfect either, like something like the Gallup poll or anything. And it went from kindergarten through high school. And one other thing that came out important is working memory. Some people know what it is, and I'm not sure anyone totally understands it. It certainly is a hot topic right now, but I look at it as the ability to store abstract information in your head, which is why it becomes very important for much of mathematics. So it's not facts, but it's abstract information, concepts, strategies for solving problems. So it will be everything from really being able to store the commutative property, the base 10 knowledge, and be able to access it when needed is the key there. And one way to test it, there are others, and people are developing new tests, but the way that's been around for 80 years is reverse digit span, which a school psychologist will definitely know, where you give kids a set of numbers like that, and you just read them to them, and then you ask them to repeat them in the reverse order, which takes a lot of mental manipulations and that kind of thing. And what we'll do is we'll stop for questions at about the midpoint, which is in a few minutes. Another study, this is the same group, Paul Morgan and George Farkas, is looking at growth kindergarten through fifth grade, and they found in their case, now partly it depended the way the study was set up, growth during kindergarten was a very strong predictor. Again, what these researchers acknowledge is kindergarten is not a level playing field. There are home factors. There's also preschool factors. Some preschools do a lot of solid work with numbers. Others just do a little counting here and there. And the other thing they found was attentiveness. a very, how attentive teachers rated kindergartners turned out to be a great long-term predictor, at least up through fifth grade. So we have a sense of the things that are starting to matter in terms of long-term success, as well as what's inside the person. But there's no reason to assume that working memory with good intervention, with good instruction, cannot be improved. It seems like it can be improved. Attentiveness definitely can with different kinds of lessons. And another area that I think is critical for starting RTI is fractions, and this is why, and then we'll have our little mid-break Q&A. Mathematicians, I served on the National Math Panel, as Molly mentioned, argued and demonstrated that their feeling was that understanding fractions is critical for success in algebra. The charge of the task force was what does it take to succeed in algebra? And the reasoning, which Professor Wu from Berkeley helped me understand, is there's a level of abstractness that enters when fractions come into the picture that never enters in whole numbers. Whole numbers, you could look at even multi-digit multiplication involving hundreds of thousands, and it's still an extension of what kids can do by counting with their fingers. Fractions are very abstract. There's just so many different levels of fractions. Different numbers, like 9/12 and 3/4, can mean, well, the same number can be represented by different numerals, which is totally different than whole number. There's an infinite number of fractions between 1 and 3, and there's one and only one whole number. Finally, empirically, in this work that's soon to come out by Bob Siegler and Greg Duncan, that empirically it was shown that knowledge of fractions at the end of fifth grade, which is where the core chunk, not proportions, but fractions concepts are hit now with the Common Core, especially in 3 and 4, and operations are hit hard in grade 5. So this leads at least me to conclude that for success in algebra and beyond, we need to hit that kids who are struggling with fractions, and a lot of Americans are. And one thing that we recommend, this will be the last slide before questions, is you want, in some ways, when you think about intervention, you want to think about grade levels, but think of what the goals are. And what the panel thought is one reasonable goal is to make sure that kids understand number, that they're beginning to develop a mental number line, that they have some rudiments of number sense, that they obviously you want them to be able to add and subtract and all, but you want all of that number knowledge to be a core goal in primary grades, and that's what the panel recommended. And then starting in the intermediate grades, you want to hit fractions, even for kids who are not super strong in long division and multi-digit addition and multiplication. You still want to hit fractions so they begin to build a sense of that. And that is important in Tier 1 in terms of time allocation and in Tier 2 in terms of an instructional focus. I'm trying to look for a few questions to answer. Let's start with this one from Misty Smith, which is, what is the role of Tier 2 and Tier 3 interventionists? Should they be working on deficits, or should they parallel what is being taught in the classroom? We're going to spend quite a bit of time on that in next week, and then again when we do Tier 3. I would say in Tier 2, the quick answer, because we'll come back to this, is you want to be you want to mainly focus it on grade level standards. What you want to do is backfill when needed, but you want to build that competency on the stuff that kids are doing to build that synergy between what the third grade teacher's doing and in tier two. Tier three is more complicated. Sarah is more of an expert there, and let's put that on hold. Is it true without the foundations, they won't master concepts? That was Natalie's follow-up question. And here I'd say it, not necessarily. We'll get into that more, but I think you can work on kids who still are pretty horrible in terms of multiplying like 12 times 17, but they can still be building a sense of fractions equivalence, where fractions go on a number line, whether fractions are larger or smaller than a half. So it's a balance. Trish is asking, and we'll just do maybe a couple more, about AIMSWeb. Would I give an opinion about using it? Full disclosure, I did co-author a measure that has some similarities to AIMSWeb, but it's only meant for K and 1. And all I'll say about AIMSWeb is it's essentially a very traditional measure. It's a very traditional measure. Okay, it's back. It's a very traditional measure, and I don't think it's really been linked very well to the Common Core. I guess for some reason, mine skipped down, so let me try to... And then someone says, what is SPED? And I'm not sure I know what SPED is, so that might be something Tricia can share with the group. And I'll do one more question. I think what Misty Smith said here is that it's not well linked to the Common Core. It was developed based mainly on measures from the 80s and 90s. As well as the fact the math curriculum, as Natalie points out in the dialogue, has been accelerated from the way it was in the 80s and the 90s. I would, in terms of one of Trisha's and Misty's, has been an interesting dialogue there. I don't want to get into all of it. I'd still try to keep a pace of the hard areas that become predictable in grade level material if you have kids perhaps only twice a week. I would not use AIMSWeb or Dibble's math or any other measure, STAR or any other measure, to dictate what I teach. The purpose of screening measures really is to screen, to predict. It really isn't to dictate curricula for interventions. I think I'm going to go back to this, and we'll have more time for questions at the end. And they are good ones, and this dialogue's great. Issues that come up, whether to use time measures or not, isn't a big issue. One that comes up a little bit, but I think it's kind of been answered in math, is whether to use a general outcome measure, like oral reading fluency, in reading, which at least typically in grades 2 to 4, grades 2 to 5, correlates pretty well with reading achievement, whether such a measure exists in math, or whether to do something that's Lynn Fuchs called curriculum sampling. It's sometimes called, now would be more standard sampling or critical content sampling. Something that basically takes your major year-end objectives and samples through them. I think in K-1 there are some measures that have some, utility, but basically we have to use some version of sampling across a wide range of areas. The other one I want to talk about is very, very new. It is not widely used, but there's data that's quite solid for its use. It's a number line estimation task, and it's based on the original theory Robbie Case had that the mental number line, as children learn and understand math, their mental number line becomes increasingly sophisticated. And, of course, that becomes the cornerstone for the work they do in pre-algebra and algebra. And it's seeming like potentially a powerful tool. This is our last poll. Let's give this one a shot now. And I don't know that they're right or wrong answers, but it gives us a chance to get a sense of what people think and know, and then we'll do more on screening. Start in about 10 seconds. I think probably most people have voted on these issues if they've seen. The first one, screening measures can provide useful diagnostic information. Originally, when people would be talking about this at Vanderbilt University, University of Oregon, University of Minnesota, some of the kind of beginning folks with RTI and math, the answer would be definitely no. I think it's not totally clear at this point. I think there are many times where the screeners are meant to be short and efficient, and they're too primitive to give you a lot of diagnostic information. So my sense is, especially for kids at the lower end, which would be including the lower end of tier two, or kids who are kind of pervasively having problems in math, you do want to go beyond them. They try, and with technology it's become easier, but they are very brief tests, so I wouldn't have super faith. I'd probably go rarely true for that, but I'm not sure everyone would agree with me, and obviously they don't, but... This is one that really split the group pretty much evenly. Are time measures the best? I don't think the answer is known. I know when really probably the founder of the use of time measures for screening and progress monitoring, Stan Dino, began developing them in the mid-1980s, almost 30 years ago, efficiency was important. Number one, efficiency was important. Number two, there was a sense that for reading fluency, oral reading fluency, if you timed, it was a much better predictor of comprehension than an untimed measure. I don't know that this has really been put to a fair test. So I think the grouping split is equally true, but I would not assume that. I would not make that assumption. It's a preference of many test developers, but I wouldn't make that assumption. Here, I think, rarely true, integrating formative assessments, integrating formative assessments people haven't worked out how to do it. And that is something that I think is going to be extraordinarily helpful for how to guide your interventions. And we're all beginning, really, to do interventions in math. So I see that issue, integration of formative assessments, as they become more available and even people do some validity and reliability work with them, as being critical. And in terms of the benchmark administration in the spring, for some reason, Molly, I think I lost that on my screen, the fourth poll item. I'm not sure. Basically, my feeling is I'm not sure it's useful. It's a tradition, but I think it's just something to think about. When I've asked people, I don't know, because this is why, and I think most of you agree with me. Great. Yeah, because that was the one I, let's see. Okay, most of you think it's, yeah, that's what I figured. Okay. Benchmark administration in the spring. If you find it useful, that's great. My sense is what I might be most interested in by the spring is how kids do on the state assessment. What are the areas they're falling down in? Because if we have imperfect screening measures that are somewhat out of date and we don't even know how well correlated they are with the new assessments. It's too early to do that. I think I would just think about if it is useful. I know it gives a sense of closure, and it can give a sense of accomplishment, but it's just something to think about, what purpose it really serves. And I know I'm probably being the minority here, but I wanted to throw these ideas out for you guys as much to discuss among yourselves as a little bit in the chats here. So this has been, I think, useful for all of us, because these are exactly the issues that I think people are talking about. I like to shake things up a little bit. We could move on with our next slide, Molly, but this was really quite interesting to get. Oh, and I'm going to have to go quick now, but I think I can do that. Because some of this more procedural stuff, I think many of you have experience with RTI, and you know that some of these still happen in some places. People just get lost in the procedure, and they don't sit down, and how what this means for the set of kids in the school, which is good practice. It's excellent practice. But don't spend enough time on why are we doing this? What have we learned the last 4 years using Program Z for screening? And what are the chronic problems that we have that it doesn't meet, needs it doesn't meet? Layering of data sources. Some places do screening measures, and there are district benchmark assessments given 3 times a year, 4 times a year. And there are too many tests, and people just have all this data sitting there, or it's sitting in some data room or where the RTI staff is. But thinking about cutting down and using things that are really useful. And this is less of an issue now of Title I sometimes needing yet other testing, but if that happens, that's another problem. I think it's getting back here to from the Salvi and Eiseldyke textbook that we really want to know if an assessment is valid. This is what Sam Messick called consequential validity. Is it useful? Does it help us make decisions? And that's probably the key. And the key goal in screening measures is not its diagnostic ability, but how well it predicts. That's the key thing to look for. What the practice guide has to say, the evidence was moderate. Some of you were surprised by it. It was mainly a lot lower grades, not tons of data. I bet if it were updated now, it would be higher. The reliabilities usually are decent, and math, you usually get much better reliabilities than reading because that's the nature of math. When we looked at predictive validity, they were okay. They weren't as good as often folks have gotten in reading. And in the earlier years, people didn't report on terms that we got from public health, like sensitivity and specificity. I'm going to talk about specificity in a bit, because I think it's important to at least think about. And my goal, as you can see here, is more to stir up the pot in your thinking. This is a major resource. That is the website. It's from the National RTI Center. It is updated. The center is defunct, but it still is updated. And this is just a little snippet from there. But they look at assessments and people who with good technical skills look at their reliability, their validity, and if you click on the actual measure, you'll get a much more detailed technical report, how long it takes, and you see like the Ames-Webb quantity discrimination is 2 minutes. So that obviously is the efficiency, easy CBM, 30 minutes. We'll see more and more of these that are not only computer scored, but computer administered. And there's something called a formative assessment that is quite variable. The reason I just gave MAP as an example, those are adaptive tests, and that is something I predict we'll see more of. The content, I think I already dealt with it, that many are, most people do some sort of sampling. Often then things are put into two buckets, either computation or concepts and applications. And you Common Core certainly stresses linking instruction to two of them, whether that will continue to be the best way to assess kids and think about intervention and instruction. I am not totally sure it is. I want to think you should all raise that issues. Most predictive validity is fall to spring. If they have it out further, like 4 years out, that's great. And I would really consider that important. These are examples, and many of you are familiar with them. These are things in the ESPINS measure we use. They're in AIMS-Webb. They're in a lot of different measures. Magnitude comparison seemed critical to me. It tends for all the measures for young kids to have the best predictive validity of all the short measures, because I think in part it's a quick way to gauge the sophistication of kids' mental number line. This battery, which is quite a bit lengthier than Nancy Jordan and others developed, I don't want to either push it. It's just out there. It's basic. It covers all the different aspects of number sense, including story problems, based on very interesting observation. Very young kids have a much easier time with story problems than computation. And some people are finding the same in Teaching Algebra 1, very recent research. So this one has predictive validity 4 years out, which is kind of nice. And this is just examples from the number sense battery from just one cluster there. So there's a lot on magnitude comparison and fusion. This is the number line task. It is not yet commercially available, but it could well soon be. And what you basically do, and this is done on the computer, is you have a number line. In this case, it goes from 0 to 1,000. For some reason, there was a bar over 1,000 that disappeared and some transmission. And you ask kids where 87 goes or where 640 goes, and their score is literally how far away they are from what, you know, the computer says it should be. And it turns out to be quite a neat predictor of how kids do in math. So it's something to think about. It's a pain in the butt when it had to be hand-scored, but on the computer's fine with it. It starts off, of course, for young kids with 0 to 1 and 0 to 2. Fractions are added in. And to go back to this for a second, the other thing I think it gets at, based on some of the correlations we're doing at our fraction center, is it gets at proportional reasoning, because you could see if some kids still think 87 is a real big number, they're going to put it quite close. You know, they may put it almost midway between 0 and 1,000. And as kids develop a sense of proportional reasoning, they don't. I think a lot of issues in screening are going to be revisited, and I'm going real fast here, but this is unlikely to be new to many of you. The typical 25 problems, it has some limits as a diagnostic measure. It's not terrible. These are some examples. There are many more. The curriculum sampling is the way most people go. This is an example of a concepts and applications that many of you have seen. And this is from EasyCVM that was aligned to it was aligned to the NCTM focal points, which are more closely linked to Common Core than were other earlier state standards. This is just one in algebra. Ann Fagan has done, who was on the panel, some interesting work. And this is just interesting to see. This is algebra foundations, basically a way to gauge algebra readiness. And then there was another one on algebra, you know, knowledge and procedures. And just want to give you examples. And this is, of course, downloadable. You can look at them. Any questions, you know, if you send anything to Molly in the center, they'll be forwarded to me. And this, again, the idea to having someone who really knows math, either a math educator or a research mathematician, or someone who really knows math on a team, and math RTI is good because they can help solve some problems. And I think at this point, I'm just going to go to last point, because we want to have 15 minutes or a lot of questions, and we need a few minutes for the evaluation. Specificity is something that only in the last 4 years or so has a lot of attention gone to it. What it refers to is false positives. It's how many kids that you're treating, that you're giving an intervention to, tier two especially, are kids who do totally fine without it. And I'm not taking aim at any of these, but you get to see two different philosophies here. The first one called CBM Mathematics, and the second one called AIMS-Web. What they really try to do is, the left column is hit everyone who needs help. So what the validity studies that have been done have shown, that for CBM math, it shouldn't be double CBM, something happened there, but it's 0.93. It was done in one state, or I believe this was Easy CBM Mathematics. Yeah, that's what it is, and that we should change. It was 0.93, so they really hit everyone. But specificity, how many kids are getting interventions who do fine without it? It's saying 1 in 3. The same for AIMS-Web math concepts. Now, here's another example. I did that from AIMS-Web, and I'm not trying to pick out winners and losers, because as many of you know, you can adjust cut scores yourself based on your own data or your district's data, and it's a good thing to do. For Ames Web quantity discrimination, which is typically given to very young kids in the primary grades, this one went the other way. It only hit half the kids who needed help, but it wasn't wasting a lot of resources. And as some of you are saying in the comments in the chat, that RTI is meant to be a fluid system, and some kids, maybe instead of saying right away you need intervention, see how they do in a mainstream with, and see what happens come the winter assessment. And this is the other formative assessment that kind of cuts a balance between the two. But specificity is something you want to look at, because the originally people always focused on hitting everyone who needs help. That was original goals. And there's a lot of wasted resources going on. And these were the beliefs that no one should fail. But we have to think about lost resources, and also the fact that I've seen, especially in reading, so much goes into the early grades, and then no resources are left for kids in the intermediate grades who need a lot. I think some test developers are becoming more alert to this issue of balance, but it's something to investigate. I would urge, and these are just for next steps, thinking of two possible target areas. One is the primary grades, because that K-1 growth in math is just a sense, so kids can make sense out of arithmetic. So, and those interventions can be quite short, I believe, 15, 20 minutes or something. Can it be part computer and part face-to-face? Absolutely. I think increasingly thinking about computer-managed and computer-assisted instruction is a great idea, because wasting resources is there. And adaptive testing, I think, is underutilized in screening right now. And that is a way to be efficient, because kids are only getting items at a sensible level for them. But you're also being able to get the diagnostic information that all of us want. This is just one other resource that isn't updated, but it's an article we did, and it's in the reference list, and it's on universal screening, and this just gives a sense of what we tried to do for the measures that were available at that time. And we definitely included specificity, and this term that refers to how accurately the different tests hit kids who need help that year. And it shows the difference between a one-year test like this EZ-CBM and a four-year validity study like the number sense brief. And so these are the decisions you guys, you know, have to deal with, and I'll leave them up for a second while we go to some of the questions here. So I'm trying to just find a few. I'll start with this one from Kathy Brackett and others. I can work out with Molly. Maybe I could just do these answers by email, because I think there are too many to do here. And some of you have answered each other. How was growth measured from beginning of K to 1? In the NIH study, I don't recall exactly. I think it was probably a measure. It would be kind of like a curriculum sampling, but would include pre-K and all. So it was a, you know, reasonable, probably a 15, 20-minute length measure. I could look at that article. But they tested the kids, because this was a study of health, the study, the data that Greg Duncan and Robert Siegel used. So they used a reliable measure that I think would make sense to most of us, probably a lot of number sense and a little bit of basic measurement and geometry with a few shapes and stuff like that. But they weren't doing this for screening. They actually did it at a certain kids reached chronological age, and it turned out the first one was about 6 months before kindergarten started for a lot of kids. It was when they reached a certain age, so I set entry to kindergarten. And they didn't do any screening. They just looked at what predicted from the kids. So some kids did great in high school. Some kids didn't do well in high school. They were just following a representative sample. I already answered one of Misty's questions. Misty was told that RTI should be a fluid model. Do I agree with that? And I definitely do, and I think it's probably the idea of having breaks. In a lot of places, it's every 10, 12 weeks when there's the benchmark testing and all, and I would probably consider 6 weeks in figuring out which kids, either from your PM measures or from your curriculum-based measures, you know, just the ones that are come with the curriculum are doing real well, you know, I'd consider flipping, and it just seems logistically about every 5-6 weeks would seem in the ballpark. Lynn said RTI is fluid if Tier 1 core instruction is solid and done with fidelity. Otherwise, students will continue to struggle and need further intervention. She raises so many interesting issues, and I think they're all important. If Tier 1 core instruction is solid, I think it could be fluid. I think there is a problem. There is a problem because it isn't often solid. Being done with fidelity, here's where I disagree with many of my colleagues. We don't know enough, and that's one thing I stressed last week. We don't know enough about what should really go into Tier 1. We have theories, so to say somebody needs to, with fidelity, implement the investigations textbook or Saxon textbook or Scott Forsman textbook, I don't know exactly what it is. I would say with quality. But I do agree that there are some cases where the kid still needs help because the instruction in the core class isn't working, and there has been some move towards departmentalization, and I think that would be great. Yeah. So Heather is asking, Heather Slawinski, does your current math program have an on, oh no, it's another question from Heather. It was basically, how can pre-K measures predict, how could pre-K measures predict age 15 with 0.4? And what that means is essentially that the rank orderings of kids are not totally different. The best index of how similar they are from age 5 and age 15 is 40%. So there's a lot of flux and all, but there's something about that. And I think what happens is math is very abstract and hard to follow, and kids who have problems with working memory who just haven't understood math or both of those problems, they keep being like, they're not quite ready for what the teacher is talking about. Now, if Tier 1 isn't strong, and this has been true for millennia, kids can learn from textbooks and problems, and they have. You know, we obviously want great Tier 1 instruction, but some kids are just always behind. So it's not like they're saying it's a miracle and all, but they're saying it's critical, and that's a great age to reach. But I don't think what you do for interventions for 5-, 6-, and 7-year-olds is enough to get kids over the hump when the material becomes abstract and where American students in general struggle with fractions. The NAEP, the National Assessment, shows that. Okay, and Lynn is saying, if not fidelity to curriculum, fidelity to the standards, I agree with. I just wouldn't use the word fidelity because it's so easy to misunderstand it. I think if you say high quality instruction, that would be great. I saw one question about reteaching and how important it is, and I agree 100%. And in terms of quality intervention, it involves or entails reteaching. What I will do is go through these questions of probably tomorrow, get them back to Molly if I have any responses, and we'll work out a system. And I think now it's time for you to do your evaluations. And I wanted to thank you all. This is a citations list, so it's here. It's not complete. I'll add the Agadini one in there. And have a great Thanksgiving, and hope folks in Buffalo are doing okay given the flooding and all. Thank you very much.